KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
It would be hard to overstate the importance of habeas corpus, because it goes to our very personal liberty, our freedom.
The Trump administration says it is considering suspending habeas corpus. Can it do that?
Today is Friday, May 23rd, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, more tariff threats create more chaos on Wall Street.
This time, the president is criticizing Apple and the European Union.
I would hope that this would light a fire under the EU.
Also, the Trump administration plans to close an office focusing on environmental justice.
We'll visit a part of Louisiana that's already feeling that impact.
You know, we noticed the difference in the quality of the air, the odors. The plants that would die.
Also, we'll remember a man who was known as a human U-boat for evading the Nazis during World War II.
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump is significantly downsizing his National Security Council. NPR's Quil Lawrence reports a large number of staff were terminated abruptly this afternoon.
Trump appears to be cutting the size of the National Security Council back to where it was during his previous term, according to sources that spoke to NPR on condition of anonymity to discuss internal conversations. One U.S. official who lost their job said news of terminations came at 4:30 p.m., with instructions to leave the office by 5 p.m. The National Security Council is made up of subject matter experts that advise the president on a broad range of issues. Trump previously fired other members of the council at the suggestion of far-right activist Laura Loomer. His first national security advisor, Mike Waltz, was removed from the job less than 100 days in after he accidentally leaked military plans to a journalist. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is currently also acting as national security advisor. Quil Lawrence, NPR News.
President Trump has signed several executive orders aimed at giving a boost to nuclear power. As NPR's Jeff Bromfield reports, some worry the orders could affect safety at America's reactors.
Some of the orders encourage the building of new test reactors and mining uranium, but the most controversial calls for the reorganization of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The NRC was set up as a powerful independent watchdog. Trump's executive order calls on it to speed approvals and reconsider radiation safety standards. Allison McFarland is a former NRC chair. She says having the White House interfere with nuclear regulations is a bad idea.
I'm very concerned this will affect nuclear safety in the U.S. Very concerned.
But supporters of the order say it will help speed development of new reactors that could power things like data centers used for artificial intelligence. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
A luxury jetliner gifted to the U.S. government by Qatar is waiting for a specialized overhaul to become the next Air Force One. This after the U.S. officially accepted the gift earlier this week. But as NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports, it will likely take a significant amount of money and time to overhaul the plane.
President Trump has suggested the plane could be converted quickly, but experts say it will likely take years to rework it to meet the current standards set for Air Force One. Doug Berkey, executive director of the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies, says the plane from Qatar is likely more luxurious than the current Air Force One, but there's no way it has any of the necessary communications or self-defense features required.
Installing those is not an easy thing. I mean, you have to deconstruct the aircraft a fair amount to do that.
That will cost hundreds of millions. In the meantime, Boeing already has two planes in production to replace Air Force One, but they're long delayed. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks are going into the long holiday weekend on a bit of a down note amid the latest Trump tariff threats. The Dow dropped 256 points. The Nasdaq fell 188 points today. This is NPR. Musician Billy Joel is canceling all his scheduled concerts because of a medical diagnosis. NPR's Jennifer Manasco has more.
A statement on Billy Joel's website says that he has a brain condition called normal pressure hydrocephalus. Excess fluid collects in the brain, leading to problems with hearing, vision, and balance. Joel is undergoing physical therapy, and his doctor has advised him to stop performing while he recovers, the statement said. He had been scheduled to perform concerts across the country with other artists, including Rod Stewart, Stevie Nicks, and Sting. Joel has been performing steadily since the 1970s. However, until recently, he hadn't released new pop music in decades. That drought ended early last year with his new single called Turn the Lights Back On, which he performed live at the Grammy Awards. Jennifer Venasco, NPR News, New York.
A Paris jury has found the ringleader and seven other individuals guilty in the 2016 armed robbery of Kim Kardashian. Two other individuals were acquitted in the case. Sentences being read by the court ranged from time in prison to fines. The stiffest sentence went to the 69-year-old ringleader of the operation, who received 8 years in prison, though five of those were suspended. Three other individuals in the case were also sentenced to prison time. The group was found guilty of forcing their way into an apartment where Kardashian was staying in 2016, tying her up and stealing jewelry worth millions of dollars. Crude oil futures prices moved higher today as some buyers moved in ahead of the long holiday weekend. Oil up 33 cents a barrel to $61.53 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing about the state of housing in America on the After the Fact podcast, available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact, and the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem got a pop quiz at a Senate hearing this week. The question came from Democratic Senator Maggie Hassan of New Hampshire.
Secretary Noem, what is habeas corpus?
Well, habeas corpus is a constitutional right that the president has to be able to remove people from this country
That's incorrect.
And we will get to the actual correct definition of habeas corpus in a moment. But the reason that this bit of Latin is under discussion now is because the Trump administration says it is considering suspending habeas corpus. This core constitutional protection has been an obstacle to the president's mass deportation plan. Amanda Tyler is a law professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and she joins us now to talk about Trump's proposal. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. So I just want to start with the very basics here. Under the U.S. Constitution, what is habeas corpus and what does it protect against?
Well, literally, habeas corpus is to undergo and receive the body. And what does that mean? Mm-hmm. It means that in Anglo-American legal tradition, courts have the right and indeed the obligation, when asked, to look into the legal justification for someone being arrested and detained by the government. And so for centuries, that is the role that courts have played. They have work to ensure that the executive, whether it's the King of England or the President of the United States, is not detaining somebody illegally.
Right. And in very plain terms, why should the average American care very much about habeas corpus?
It would be hard to overstate the importance of habeas corpus in our constitutional tradition because it goes to our very personal liberty, our freedom. And we have always had that security, except for in the very rare situations of suspension, that we could go to a court if we're being deprived of our liberty unlawfully and win redress, win release.
Well, the White House Deputy Chief of Staff, Stephen Miller, told reporters that the Trump administration was considering suspending habeas corpus. How big of a deal is it?
It is such a big deal. We've had suspensions only extremely rarely in American history in situations like the Civil War and the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And specifically what the Constitution requires is a rebellion or invasion and for the public safety to warrant suspension. And the effect of a suspension is effectively to shutter the courts. And that's why in a case that was argued to the Supreme Court after 9/11, late Justice Souter once said, suspension is just about the most stupendously significant thing the government can do.
Can you explain why the phrase habeas corpus is even coming up in the courts right now with respect to President Trump's immigration actions?
The reason it's coming up and become so prominent is because all of the challenges to the president's actions in this immigration context and all of the removals that he's trying to undertake, particularly under his proclamation with respect to the Alien Enemies Act, they're all coming through habeas petitions brought by individuals who've been arrested and are being detained and are at risk of being removed from the country expeditiously. In large measure, I should say, because the Supreme Court has, in an early emergency order a few weeks ago, said this is how they should proceed.
Okay. You mentioned that there are some limited circumstances under which habeas corpus could be constitutionally suspended. Can you first talk about whether the President of the United States can unilaterally suspend habeas corpus?
This is a really important question, and the answer is a categorical no. The president does not have the power to suspend habeas ahead of Congress. The founding generation, first and foremost, put the suspension clause in Article 1 of the Constitution, which is the legislative article.
Congress.
Right. That is the article that governs how Congress, its powers, how it's assembled, etc.
So is there an example in U.S. history where a president tried to unilaterally suspend habeas corpus?
Yes. I mean, the classic example here is Abraham Lincoln. And a lot of people point to his example as supporting the notion that the president has this power. But the story is a lot more complex, because as he was proclaiming suspensions on his own, courts were questioning his actions right and left. And so the Lincoln administration actually went eventually to Congress and said, we really need legal cover. We need you to pass suspension legislation. And after Congress did so, he not only issued a new suspension, he specifically referenced the legislation that Congress had passed as justifying it. And in so doing, I think Lincoln all but conceded that he had been acting unlawfully up until that point.
Well, this current Supreme Court has been willing, or seems to be willing, to grant the president very broad powers. How do you see Stephen Miller's argument, the Trump administration's argument, going before the current justices if President Trump does attempt to suspend habeas corpus with respect to his immigration actions?
There are so many issues that will come up if the president were to do this. There's the first question of whether the president has the power to do this. And this is a court that is populated with a number of justices who care very deeply about history, and many of whom are originalists. And so they're going to care a lot about what the founding generation thought. And there's just really overwhelming evidence that the president doesn't have this power. So I think that would be probably the start and end. But if the court were to go further, it would also look at whether there is potentially an invasion or rebellion that justifies the suspension. And the court may have to do that in any event, because by invoking the Alien Enemies Act, President Trump has declared that there is an invasion, and that's the predicate for him having exercised that emergency power. And that issue is now percolating in the lower courts. And I think the case for the administration's position is very weak here.
Amanda Tyler is a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of Habeas Corpus in Wartime, From the Tower of London to Guantanamo Bay. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
In just 24 hours, there have been major developments in the battle between the Trump administration and Harvard University. Yesterday, the administration revoked Harvard's ability to admit international students. This morning, the school sued, and then a judge issued a temporary restraining order. So for now, the administration's action is on pause. NPR's Janaki Mehta is back with us, and she has the latest. Hi, Janaki.
Hey, Ari.
So bring us up to speed on what has happened.
Yeah, so yesterday the Trump administration sent Harvard a letter saying it would revoke the certification that allows it to admit international students. Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem said in a statement that the administration was, quote, holding Harvard accountable for fostering violence, anti-Semitism, and coordinating with the Chinese Communist Party on its campus. The administration had also told currently enrolled international students they'd have to transfer to another university. And then, as you said, less than 24 hours later, Harvard filed a lawsuit which calls the Trump administration's actions a, quote, campaign of retribution. And a federal judge has now granted Harvard a temporary restraining order against the Trump administration.
What does that temporary restraining order do?
So it temporarily stops the government from revoking Harvard's certification that allows it to admit international students. You know, part of what's so striking is that the back and forth between Harvard and the Trump administration has moved so fast. I spoke to Carl Tobias, a professor of law at the University of Richmond in Virginia, and he pointed out one of the reasons the federal judge has been able to move quickly.
She didn't even bother to wait to hear about all the evidence because it had already been in the public realm by the way in which Noam and the president have criticized Harvard publicly over and over again.
Now, the Trump administration seems to be suggesting they might appeal. I reached out to DHS, which sent a comment from Assistant Secretary Tricia McLaughlin. In part, she said, quote, "The Trump administration is committed to restoring common sense to our student visa system, and we expect a higher court to vindicate us in this."
Can you tell how strong Harvard's case is against the Trump administration here?
Yeah, the legal scholars I've spoken to, including Carl Tobias, seem to think they have a strong case. In addition to Harvard's argument that the Trump administration is infringing upon its First Amendment rights, the suit also says that the administration is in violation of the sorts of legal procedures required for withdrawing a school's certification to admit international students. The government can and does rescind those kinds of certifications, but usually it has proof that a university is in violation of certain, like, administrative procedures, for example, failing to maintain accreditation. Instead, in her initial letter, DHS Secretary Kristi Noem gave Harvard 72 hours to turn over records and audio and video footage involving international students taking part in protests or in dangerous activity.
This doesn't just affect Harvard, it affects thousands of students, more than a quarter of the student population. Can they now breathe a sigh of relief, or are they in limbo? What's the status?
Yeah, I mean, at least for now, we'll have to see how the legal proceedings play out. I've been in touch primarily with students, international students at Harvard, and they didn't want to be named because they fear retaliation from the U.S. government. But one student who's set to graduate in a week told me she's just had a roller coaster of emotions. Not total relief yet, she said, still lots of anxiety. But also, she said, these early actions from Harvard make her hopeful that the university will do what it can to protect international students. And she pointed out that students like her across the country don't just contribute to research and bring jobs to the economy, but also bring unique cultural perspectives that strengthen universities like Harvard. And I mean, all right, international students at Harvard, like you said, they make up over 27% of the student body at the moment, and across the nation, more than a million international students attended higher education institutions in the U.S. last year. And according to federal data, those students contributed more than $50 billion to the U.S. economy in 2023. Many of them are now wondering if they have a future in this country.
That is NPR's Janaki Mehta. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Earlier this year, the Trump administration announced plans to close an office at the Environmental Protection Agency, an office tasked with protecting the most vulnerable Americans from environmental harms. Now, many of the tools that communities used to figure out where pollution is happening, they've disappeared. NPR's Nate Perez visited one community in Louisiana where the loss of pollution data is already having an impact.
85-year-old Robert Taylor drives me around his hometown, Reserve, Louisiana, in his red pickup truck.
This was originally dairy farm. All of this was cow pastures.
We end up in front of the two-story brick house Taylor built in St. John Parish in 1969. By then, he noticed a change in the demographics.
The white people were moving out. This area here, which was maybe 10% black, is right now 99% black.
Taylor says the white population in Reserve left before the DuPont plant began operating next door. He says there were other changes, too.
You know, we noticed the difference in the quality of the air, the odors, the plants that were dying.
That synthetic rubber plant announced this month it would indefinitely suspend production. Danka, which runs the plant, cites financial losses as the reason. But Taylor says the damage has already been done.
That house right there, the father survived the first attack of cancer. 10 years later, he came back and killed him.
Robert, you're telling me there, here, there, all affected?
I didn't go this way. They call this place Cancer Alley.
Cancer Alley. This is where more than 150 petrochemical facilities and oil refineries operate along the Mississippi River corridor between New Orleans and Baton Rouge. Kim Terrell's with Tulane University's Environmental Law Clinic. She says an Environmental Protection Agency tool called EJ Screen helped St. John make a big discovery.
EJ Screen indicated that that community had more cancer risk than anywhere else in the nation.
A recent Johns Hopkins study found a total of 45 hazardous air pollutants in Louisiana's river parishes. National emission standards were set for some of those pollutants under the Biden administration. It was a start, says Gail LaBeouf, a lifelong resident of St. James Parish, which is not far from St. John.
So you had people trying to work within the system that exists to give some help, but we're seeing all that pushback now.
That pushback she talks about comes from President Trump, who signed an executive order earlier this year to end DEI programs. As part of that, EJ Screen was removed in February. Then the administration sent nearly 300 letters to staffers at the EPA's Environmental Justice and External Civil Rights Office that they could be fired. Matthew Tejada is a former official at the EJ office.
It was really under President Biden that you saw the government really start to evolve towards being more equitable and more just.
Tejada points to Justice 40 as an example. It promised to deliver at least 40% of federal climate programs to overpolluted communities. Tejada says it was an effort to bring benefits to the most vulnerable communities.
Because they're not making it to the folks that deserve those benefits the most, because they're the least protective.
But not everyone agrees with Tejada. The EPA spokesperson, Molly Vasilou, said in an email that environmental justice has been used primarily as an excuse to fund left-wing activist groups instead of addressing specific environmental issues. But many in the river parishes disagree with that. Gail LaBeouf says they're going to keep fighting for clean air and water.
The fight is about democracy and equal justice under the law.
But without EJ Screen, LaBeouf says that fight has only become harder. Researchers have archived EJ Screen, but if the data isn't updated, the tool becomes obsolete. That's why the Sierra Club and other groups are now suing the federal government to get EJ Screen and other data back as a federal tool, so that people like Robert Taylor and others in the river parishes can fight for a healthy environment. Nate Perez, NPR News.
During World War II, thousands of Jews evaded the Nazis in Berlin, moving from place to place and taking refuge wherever they could. They called themselves U-boats, a reference to the German naval submarines that operated in the Atlantic Ocean, diving below the waves to avoid detection so they could attack Allied ships.
Living submerged in the daily life of Berlin, Walter Frankenstein was one of around 1,700 human U-boats who survived the war in the city. He died last month at 100 years old.
He spent his later years educating people about his experience, keeping the memory of the U-boats alive.
Es waren sehr viele Flugangriffe, also außer dass überall.
This is Frankenstein speaking about his experience at an event organized by the Jewish Museum Berlin in 2018.
Frankenstein was born in 1924 in a small German town that is now part of Poland. When he was 12, Jews could no longer attend his town school, so he moved to a Jewish orphanage in Berlin.
Der Unterschied war aber auch sehr groß, indem man in Berlin anonym war.
As a young boy, he benefited from the anonymity of the city. He says back in his hometown, everyone knew he was Jewish, but in Berlin, he could blend in with the crowd.
The sheer size of Berlin, over 4 million people, simply made it easier. It was still incredibly difficult and dangerous, but it did make it easier to fade into the shadows and the background.
Richard Lutyens is a professor of modern German history at Texas Tech University. He says this is how many Jewish people hiding in Berlin were able to avoid arrest or deportation. That anonymity helped some people in hiding hold jobs and retain some semblance of normal life.
One gentleman used to play the organ at funerals. Another individual who was a talented artist. He used to paint anti-Nazi paintings and sell them to support himself. One gentleman went so far as he was bored and he wanted to learn how to sail. So he got himself a sailboat and used to go sailing. We would consider a lot of these forms of behavior, I think, from our perspective, as foolhardy, but it's what kept body and soul together. It wasn't just about surviving, it was about attempting to live.
Frankenstein married his wife Leonie in 1942, and their two sons were born during the war. As the Nazi persecution of Jews intensified, the family moved from place to place, sometimes together, other times separated. They dodged air raids in whatever shelter they could find. An opera house, a stranded car, a brothel, a subway station.
After the war, the family spent a decade in Israel, then moved to Sweden. There, Frankenstein studied to become a civil engineer. He frequently spoke about his experiences, and in 2014, he was awarded the German Order of Merit. That's one of the government's highest honors for his contributions to Holocaust remembrance.
Frankenstein often kept the medal with him, along with the Yellow Star of David that the German government forced all Jews to wear during the war.
This is NPR News.
Tom Cruise has starred in almost every genre of film, from romance to action to psychological thriller. But there is one common thread running through all of his work. Tom Cruise never phones it in.
This guy has built up over the course of a career a passionate, some might say even maniacal, devotion to the movies.
What made Cruise's star power go supernova? On All Things Considered, from NPR News. We'll be right back.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Coming up, if you've been feeling like you need to let loose a primal scream, Rico Nasty is here to help.
People aren't coming to the shows because I'm cute. They're coming to the shows because they want to get stuff off their chest, and I provide them a space for that.
Her new album, after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Sources tell NPR the White House has fired several members of the National Security Council staff aimed at reducing the size of the agency down to that of President Trump's first administration. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has added the NCS to his duties for now after the former head of the NCS was reassigned. European officials say President Trump's threat to impose a 50% tariff on the EU will cause suffering in both the U.S. and Europe. NPR's Rob Schmitz has more.
German Foreign Minister Johann Wadepool said Germany will be counting on further negotiations with the Trump administration, as well as support from the European Commission in defending the European market from Trump's threatened 50% tariff, which, in a post on Truth Social, he said the U.S. would impose starting in June. The president also threatened a 25% tariff on Apple products unless iPhones begin to be manufactured in America. The European Commission's stance on trade with the U.S. is that it's roughly in balance if both goods and services are calculated. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
Elon Musk's Doge team is using AI to analyze data. One of the tools they're using is Musk's own service. NPR's Bobby Allen has more.
Musk's Doge staffers are tapping generative AI systems to crunch massive amounts of taxpayer data. Musk's teams have been utilizing AI platforms developed by Meta, Palantir, and even Musk's own AI system known as Grok. Doge's use of Grok, which was first reported by Reuters, has raised alarms among ethics experts, who say it appears to be the latest example of Musk's self-dealing in the federal government, and it could violate conflict of interest laws and put at risk the sensitive personal data of millions of Americans. The White House didn't return a request for comment, but the Trump administration has previously said that Doge has not given preferential treatment to any AI tool or product. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Wall Street lower by the closing bell. The Dow down 256 points, NASDAQ down 188. This is NPR News. In France, eight people were found guilty in connection with a 2016 multi-million dollar armed jewelry robbery of Kim Kardashian at her rented apartment in Paris. The 69-year-old ringleader of the group was sentenced to 8 years of prison, five of which were suspended. He and some of his co-defendants were also found guilty of crimes including kidnapping, possession of weapons, and aggravated theft. Two other defendants were acquitted. A new home screening test for cervical cancer is now available to some women in the U.S. NPR's Katie Riddles has more.
Cervical cancer is a highly preventable disease, and yet it still kills thousands of women every year. In part, that's because people typically have to go into the doctor's office to get a screening. Now the FDA has approved a mail-in test that people can take at home. Dr. Alexi Wright is with the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute.
This is amazing because it advances the field by allowing women to self-test and to, you know, get the results.
The test is available right now only in California through a company called Teal Health. The company is working to expand access. Wright and other experts say the results are just as accurate as tests in the doctor's office. They caution, however, that testing is only useful if people follow up. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
Retail sales were up just 0.1% in April, a sharp slowdown from sales numbers in March. A bright spot, homeowners spending on home renovation projects, sending sales at building suppliers higher. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru, the new Forester Hybrid offers symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 581 miles per tank, part of the new Forester Hybrid family of SUVs. More at Subaru.com/ForesterHybrid. And from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Stocks fell sharply this morning after President Trump issued two new tariff threats. Some of those losses were later reversed, but markets are still ending the week on a down note. It's a reminder for investors that the president's trade war is not over, and there are new concerns about the rising federal debt. NPR's Scott Horsley is here to explain. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Ari.
Let's start with the president's latest trade tirades. Who's he targeting this time?
The European Union and Apple. It's become kind of a familiar pattern now. The president took to social media this morning to rattle his tariff saber. He complained that trade talks with the EU have been, quote, going nowhere. And he threatened to impose a 50% tax on all imports from the European Union unless that changes by June 1st. By the way, 50% would be five times the import tax that Americans are paying on European goods right now. Trump told reporters this afternoon he's playing hardball.
I just said it's time that we play the game the way I know how to play the game.
Now, history suggests the way Trump plays this game is often to threaten big tariffs and then backtrack after a market sell-off. Trump is also threatening to impose a 25% tax on iPhones unless Apple starts building those phones here in the United States.
Is that likely to work?
Doubtful. Up until now, smartphones have been largely spared from the president's trade war, so a 25% tax would be a big escalation if it actually happened, but probably not big enough to actually move iPhone manufacturing into the U.S. One analyst estimated that if Apple even tried to build iPhones here in this country, they would cost around $3,500, which is a lot more than the imported version, even with a 25% tariff. That analyst, Dan Ives of Wedbush Securities, described the concept of Apple making iPhones here as, quote, a fairy tale.
This is a big change from a week ago when we got good news on tariffs and the stock market soared. Why the turnaround?
Yeah, last week we saw huge gains in the market after the U.S. and China agreed to temporarily suspend their most punishing tariffs. And investors may have concluded, perhaps prematurely, that the trade war was over, even though a lot of importers are very much aware that it's only a temporary truce. Even with that partial rollback, Americans are still paying the highest import taxes since the Great Depression almost a century ago. Now, the president has been pressuring retailers to eat those tariffs and not pass them on to consumers, but that's probably not realistic given how high these import taxes are. And as we've seen again today, the president may not be done issuing tariffs. You know, we're operating in a world where on any given morning, Donald Trump can wake up and call for double-digit taxes on goods from any country or any company. And of course, that's only part of what's rattling the stock market this week. The other fear factor is the turmoil in the bond market, which is tied to rising government debt.
Tell us more about that. How's the bond market looking as we head into the long weekend?
Yeah, bond yields are still elevated, which is another reason that all the major stock indexes are down about 2.5% for the week. It was just a week ago that Moody's stripped the federal government of its AAA bond rating, suggesting that the U.S. government is not quite as good a credit risk as had long been assumed. Now, this week, the House added to that concern by passing that big tax cut and spending bill, which would add trillions of dollars in additional red ink over the next decade. So bondholders are demanding higher interest rates to hold on to U.S. government debt. That means the government has to pay more to borrow money, and so does everyone else. You know, mortgage rates, for example, were already high, which is why there's been a slump in the housing market this year. And now they're climbing higher. Freddie Mac says the average rate on a 30-year home loan is now 6.86%.
NPR's Scott Horsley, thank you.
You're welcome.
So far, the highest profile witness to testify in the criminal trial of hip-hop tycoon Sean Combs has been his ex-girlfriend, singer Cassie Ventura. In often intense moments on the stand, she told the jury that he raped and abused her. This trial, though, is bigger than Diddy versus Cassie, as NPR culture correspondent Anastasia Tsioulkas explains, and a warning, her report contains descriptions of physical and sexual violence.
If most people know one thing about the relationship between Sean Combs and Cassie Ventura, it's probably a widely seen video of Combs attacking her in a California hotel in 2016. Combs was seen kicking and dragging her and throwing a vase at her, footage that has been key in this trial. But because this is a federal trial, says lawyer and former prosecutor Jennifer Beidle, the prosecutors have a different job.
What they really need to show from a prosecution perspective is that there was a criminal organization in play here that committed a number of illegal acts over time. So simply finding that Cassie Ventura was the subject of domestic violence, while that's obviously awful and a very important thing from a state court level, doesn't satisfy the federal standard.
Here's what those charges mean. First, sex trafficking and transportation to engage in prostitution. The government is accusing Combs of coercing women into participating in commercial sex acts with him and with male sex workers. He also allegedly arranged for women and sex workers to be flown to him across state lines. That's a big part of what Cassie Ventura testified about. She said she felt forced to participate and that she could not safely leave. Combs' defense team is arguing that Ventura chose to stay in a toxic relationship. Racketeering is the most complicated charge to understand. Jennifer Beidle says back in the day, the feds used to use racketeering charges, also known as RICO, to fight organized crime.
RICO is traditionally a statute that was designed to prosecute the mob and other organizations that were essentially hiding their conduct through legitimate organizations. You might have an otherwise legitimate business that is also engaged in criminal misconduct and maybe using that legitimate business to hide that criminal misconduct.
Prosecutors are arguing that while Sean Combs had a legitimate business empire, he was using his businesses to fuel and hide criminal activities. Think of this charge as being like money laundering, but instead of money, Combs was allegedly laundering actions. According to the federal indictment, those included kidnapping, arson, bribery, forced labor, and abusing and coercing women. Many of the other government witnesses are testifying about those activities. Beidle says the prosecution might have had to present Cassie Ventura as a witness very early on. She's 8.5 months pregnant. But it may have a broader benefit. Ventura was involved with Combs for over a decade.
She covers a pretty long time frame and wide range of conduct. So you have sort of a narrator to start out with where they're getting the story in their head to some degree.
One big question, when the jury eventually begins deliberating, will they remember what Cassie Ventura said on the stand? The court estimates that this trial will go on until at least late June. Anastasia Tsioulkas, NPR News, New York.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Since 2015, groups of young people have been suing state and federal governments over climate change. Only one of those suits has made it to trial in Montana. And in December, the young people won at the state Supreme Court. Conservative Montana lawmakers responded with new bills to get around the decision. Those bills have now been signed into law. Montana Public Radio's Alice Julin reports on what's next.
University of Montana junior Olivia Vesevich is taking a break between finals, walking on a trail between campus and the Clark Fork River.
I don't see any snow on these mountains.
That's concerning at this time of year. Climate change has been shown to extend Montana's wildfire season.
I would love if my teenage years were not defined by climate change.
Vesevich is one of the 16 youth plaintiffs who won, based on Montana's constitution guaranteeing the right to a clean and healthy environment. The court ruled that includes a stable climate. The decision outraged conservatives, who argue that because climate change is a global issue, Montana cannot be held responsible for it.
To watch our legislatures actively dismiss a constitutional ruling is devastating.
That's not how State Senator Wiley Gault sees it. He calls the decision
gift wrap present to radical environment activists, an open door for endless lawsuits designed to shut down Montana's fossil fuel industry.
The federal government estimates that Montana is home to about a third of America's recoverable coal reserves. But the court ordered the state to consider the climate impacts of developing fossil fuel projects and their greenhouse gas emissions.
It had nothing to do with protecting the environment and everything to do with weaponizing the courts to strangle our economy.
A new law Gault sponsored appears to thread the needle of the court's decision. Montana will now inventory greenhouse gas emissions, but it won't regulate them. Other new state laws go one step further, barring Montana from regulating planet-warming emissions at all, unless the federal government does so first. That's unlikely under the Trump administration. Lawmakers could have tried to change Montana's constitution, eliminating its guarantee of environmental protection, but that's very difficult to do. University of Montana law professor Constance Van Clay says, short of that,
there has been a response to the court striking down the legislation on the part of the legislature, with the legislature kind of claiming that the Montana judiciary is out of control and super liberal.
That's been a theme for several years. Montana's conservative lawmakers and governor challenging the authority of the judicial branch. Green groups say Montanans won't stand for the new laws passed in response to the state Supreme Court decision, which means, Van Clay says, more confrontation in and with state courts.
I think it's very likely to end up being litigated.
Back on the River Trail, Olivia Vesevich says she and countless other young people will continue to feel the effects of human-caused climate change. She says she's disappointed by the Montana legislature's priorities.
They care more about protecting the fossil fuel industry than they care about protecting the lives of children.
She says the longer the state delays on climate action, the worse things will be in the future. And she hopes her lawmakers keep that in mind. For NPR News, I'm Ellis Ju Lin in Missoula, Montana.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. No one owns a song quite like Rico Nasty. Hip-hop, punk rock, and a lot of unabashed feminine confidence. These are the ingredients that have turned Rico Nasty into a genre-bending force of nature over the course of a decade.
I walk in like royalty, weed aromatherapy. They front row, they watching me. Cash out, they fight to a beat.
But even after two studio albums and establishing herself as a singular artist with frenetic energy and distinctly feminine style, Rico Nasty wanted something more. There was pressure to conform, and she said she felt creatively stifled.
When something works, there's gonna be people who tell you to keep doing it, disregarding the artistry and the art of it, of evolving, of coming out one way and leaving completely different.
So Rico Nasty made a big pivot. She walked away from her former label Atlantic Records and signed with Fueled by Ramen alongside alternative rock bands like Fall Out Boy and 21 Pilots. She's the label's first ever rapper. When I spoke to her as she released her third studio album Lethal, she said making the leap allowed her to expand her range and to feel true creative freedom.
I just felt very like seen and not ostracized. And I say that because it can feel very staggering being a female artist, and a lot of the market is sex. You know, a lot of the market is sex. But then you realize people aren't coming to the shows because I'm cute. They're coming to the shows because they want to get stuff off their chest, and I provide them a space for that. And I have to honor that. And I felt like I couldn't conform. I have to find a place that honors me and feels like I'm special. Because there's, you know, there's just, there's no way that I'm not. JK, JK, JK.
Is there a song that you'd point to on Lethal that you don't think you could have made anywhere else?
I would say Smoke Break. Well, as my other team with Atlantic wasn't necessarily blocking me creatively, I think that they slightly were stunting my growth, though. Because I wanted live instruments in the sessions. I wanted to feel like this was a band. I wanted to bring that angst from my voice into the production, and I struggled with that for years because I didn't study music in a way where it's like I went to school for it and I learned instruments. Like, I learned it from friends. I learned it from spending hours in sessions. So, you know, when you're asking them for instruments and you don't play any, I don't think they take you serious. Mm. They didn't believe that I knew what I was asking for. So records like that just remind me, like, I knew what I wanted. I knew I could do that. And just being able to be with a team that allows me to be vocal. And, you know, anytime that I get to scream, I'm just having a blast.
I always love to know where artists get their inspiration. I wonder, was there something specific that you were reading or watching, or an artist that you were listening to that really inspired the direction that you took with Lethal?
Oh, I feel like I was inspired by life. I was so inspired by life because, you know, in making this album, you know, there were moments that were harder than others. There was periods in my life that were happening that I had thought I couldn't overcome. And when I did, like, just being able to see the other side, that things can get better. So I just wanted a body of work that, encapsulates the cockiness of it all and thinking you're the best and, like, feeling like you're worse sometimes, you know? Like, I think it's super human.
You talk about those moments that are maybe harder or tougher than others. Is there a song on Lethal that was born out of one of those difficult moments that you could tell us about?
I think can't win them all.
Crush out, go AWOL, I don't want to talk. Red flags, I seen them, but I let you walk. Outline all my issues, should have wrote in chalk. You wouldn't believe all the that I saw.
I'm sure first listen, most people would think that it's about, you know, a relationship. But it's not just about, like, relationship. It's about, like, what do you do when you try your best to win everyone over and you just can't? There's just people out there sometimes who just don't like you. And I think being a Black woman in America, that's something I felt the need to touch on, super, super passionate about it because of everything that's happening right now.
Put you on a pedestal, put you on a game. It's already clear that you wouldn't do the same. Before you got with me, you didn't have a name. How can you look at yourself? You should be ashamed.
And I just wanted young women listening to my music to understand that you don't have to break your back to fit into the cookie cutter fit of what people think you should be. Like, there's no way impossible you can win everyone over, and that's okay.
I can't let you go without asking about Smile, because it's such a beautiful song and such a loving ode that I think resonates for any of us who have kids in our lives that we're caring for.
Love me back till you fall asleep. Can't believe you belong to me. Every day is everything.
Well, I feel like throughout the timeline of making this album, I have woken up every day and I take my son to school and I pick him up and I spend every day with my kid. And I would not be the person that I am if it wasn't for him.
The best parts of me is true. That I'm only smiling because of you.
You know, you go through up and downs in your career. You go through moments where everybody hates you and you're the ugliest person on earth. And you're laying in the bed and you're scrolling and you're reading the stuff people are saying about you, you know? And then your kid comes in your room and they're doing something crazy and funny and you're just like, why do I even care about these people? Like, life is right in front of me. And I'll just always be thankful for all of the laughs that he's given me over the years. He's the funniest person ever. And I just feel like that song, it was well-deserved. He needs a song like that. And I can't wait to sing it for him when he's like 20 or something. I'll be like, this is our jam. He's going to be so tired of that song.
We've been speaking with Rico Nasty. Her new album, Lethal, is out now. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Workday. Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday, moving business forever forward. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match.
I don't want you to be no slave. I don't want you to work all day, but I want you to be true, and I just wanna make love to you, love to you, ooh, love to you. All I want to do is wash your clothes. I don't want to keep you indoors.